Geopolitical Horizons, the podcast from geopolicy.com. Now, we've got exciting news for you guys. It's that time of the year where Geopolity will be publishing its annual report. It will be out on the 2nd of January, the Strategic Estimate 2023. Now, our analysts have been working hard following the key events for you guys over the past year. The trends, the patterns, you name it. I've had the privilege of getting a preview of the report, and I've got Geopolity founder Adnan Khan here with me today to discuss the reports. Now, how are you keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very well, thank you. Now, a lot of this report was kind of centered around the Ukraine war. Why did you go with this particular theme?
So, Yusuf, if you look at any annual report, annual publication, there is always a theme which strings everything together. And we did discuss this quite extensively at Geopolity, what the theme of this year should be. And I think it's probably safe to say that the Ukraine war is probably the key political event, geopolitical event of the year. And that's because if you look, it involves all the powers, Russia, European powers, you've got America, you've got China involved in some form or shape. Every country had to take a position on it. So an event which involves all the world's powers is a very important event. And no doubt, Yusuf, the outcome of the Ukraine war, whether Russia wins, whether Russia loses, will have an impact on the global situation. So if you look at 2022, there is no other event of such magnitude or of such scale that would leave a lasting impact. So for us, it was quite an easy decision to make to go with the Ukraine war as the main theme of the report.
Now, yeah, you mentioned that we've been discussing this over the past year. We've done a number of podcasts and there's been a number of reports on it. Where would you say that this war currently stands in a nutshell?
So in a nutshell, Yusuf, the war in Ukraine is at a point now where an immediate victory for either side looks unlikely. It is turned now into a slow grinding war. And now what you're finding is the economic implications have caught up with both parties. Russia has now mobilized further troops, which is going to have an economic impact. We're in Europe and the energy fallout is already having an impact on us. So really, at the moment, it looks as though this is going to be a long grinding war. The victory for either side for the moment and for the immediate future looks quite unlikely. And, you know, whatever the outcome is, it will leave a massive impact on Russia's global position. If Russia wins, Russia has strengthened, it's a global power, it's expanded its territory, it's annexed a surrounding land. Russia is a country that has to be taken seriously, has to be considered now by the other powers. If Russia loses, then it really raises a lot of issues about the country. It's military has already taken a massive hit. You know, for decades, the image of Russia created and the position of every analyst and every think tank was Russia's military is a power to be reckoned with. Look at their invasion of Georgia. Look at their invasion of Ukraine in 2014. You know, look at their participation in the war in Syria. But what we find is in a conventional war, where it's not about futuristic weapons or an air force, it's about bread and butter warfare, which is what your ground forces, equipping them, maneuver, and controlling and occupying territory. Russia's really been caught short in this particular area. So the longer this war goes on, the more of a drain it will have on Russia. And you're right, 23rd of February was when the war kicked off. So soon we were not too far from a full year. And for the moment, victory looks quite a long, dim prospect for Russia.
Now, a lot of the report was centered around, Ukraine, but US was also part of that report. And we see that there's growing issues at home. There's more political polarization. Again, this is something covered in the report. But could you go over the key findings for us?
So, America's in quite an interesting scenario. Despite its foreign policy and global action it's taken and the achievements it's had. I mean, if you take your mind back, this time last year, Yusuf, we were talking about the departure and the debacle that took place in Afghanistan. And literally a year later, America has managed to get Russia involved in a war. America is funding and arming Ukraine to bleed Russia to death. So that's actually a major achievement. But really, if you look at domestically, America has got huge problems going on. The country is just polarized when it comes to its politics. And we're not just talking about red and blue politics here, you know, whether you're Democrat or Republican. Abortion, race, economics, the differences are becoming so huge now that it's leading to the complete polarization of America. It's unlikely they're going to be able to move forward on a lot of issues because they're so polarized, they have so many differences. Next week, or about near the end of the year, the report will be coming out from the House Select Committee who looked at the Capitol Hill riots. And we'll have to see if there's going to be any slam dunk news in there. But from the looks of it, you had a president who refused to accept the electoral result. And he did everything he could to stop Joe Biden coming into power, including abusing his time in office. And as a result, his supporters stormed the Capitol Hill, the seat of American democracy. And, you know, the ideological implications of these are huge. If a segment of your population refuses to accept the electoral result, and then it does actions to show that we refuse to accept it, I mean, this is the rule of the jungle. And this is really just a snapshot of where America is and what's going on. And really, the key finding we found is if America is polarized internally, this will catch up with its global position eventually. So, you know, if you've got China, if you've got Russia, and if you're involved in every region, you're going to have eventually what you're going to have is see American actions being polarized abroad as well. So this doesn't really bode well for America, the global superpower. So many issues at home will catch up with the global position eventually.
Now, something I find unusual is that with all these problems that America has at home, they're also looking into going back to the moon. US is thinking about going back to the moon. You'd think that with all these issues here on Earth, why would they be focusing on space? Is this something maybe like the space race restarting again, especially with Russia coming out of its shell and China actually progressing?
Yeah, absolutely, Yusuf. The space race is now in full swing. America has a new program, the Artemis program, which was formally established in 2017. And they were supposed to launch this year. And despite the delays, eventually on November the 16th, the first space flight actually took place. It lifted off from Florida. And it marks the start of a new space race to mine the moon, with the US looking to secure a lead in the 21st century space race. So obviously everybody remembers the space race of the 60s and the 70s. You had, you know, the leader of the capitalist world, America. You had Russia, the Soviet Union, leading the communist bloc. You know, they competed with manufacturing powerful rockets, then going into outer space and then putting a man on the moon. So obviously we know historically America technically won the space race. In some ways, they actually drained the Soviet Union, eventually one of the factors that led to its collapse. What's really happened is once the Soviet Union collapsed, obviously the Soviet Union, Russia was in no position to engage in space, and America significantly cut the NASA budget. But there's actually been two main developments since then. The first is that whilst the previous programs were national endeavors, they were public sector endeavors by the governments of Russia, the Soviet Union, and America. What you now find is there's a significant involvement of the private sector. One of the biggest problems down to space is very expensive. The rockets needed, the technology needed to maintain human life and a significant presence out in space, whether it's the moon or around the Earth, it costs a lot of money. What's happened now is the rise of space companies such as SpaceX and other private launchers, they've actually driven down the cost of getting access into space. So what you have now is a raft of countries and a whole host of private companies, they are now engaging in space. So what we mean here is getting people and getting equipment out of the Earth's atmosphere and then trying to get to the moon and actually staying there for a significant period. The main change has been is the use of reusable rockets. I think one rocket on a space launch costs over tens of million. And the biggest cost was is the rockets only used once and that cost is gone. What private sector companies have been able to do is they've developed reusable rockets, which has significantly reduced the price of going into space. What you also find is many other countries now, China, Russia, South Korea, Iran, Turkey, even a couple of countries in Africa, they're all taking part in the different parts of getting into space. So what Washington has concluded that other countries now are getting involved. So America doesn't necessarily have a dominance in this particular area, but its main competitor is really China. China is looking to mine the moon, mine asteroids, and go further into space. So what America decided is we've got to take a lead in this particular area. The next geopolitical struggle, the next major find of resources or minerals is going to be in space. And America, with its advantage in industrial and innovation capabilities, it wants to remain ahead. So you're right, despite the problems domestically, despite its challenges globally, America seems to be quite united in America's position outside the Earth.
Now, we touched on China in the last question. China's just celebrating, or should I say, Xi Jinping is celebrating his decade in power. And now it seems like it's been a good decade for him. How would you sum up his decade in power?
So definitely, Yusuf, you're right. A lot of change has taken place in the last decade. China's economy has grown. China's capabilities have grown as well. But Xi Jinping really has been on a slightly different agenda. What you find with Xi Jinping is he spent significant time in the last decade really strengthening his own position. In fact, Xi Jinping considers himself now the leader for life. And if you look at what he's really been up to for the last 10 years, he's really been getting rid of all opposition to his rule. And he's effectively made himself the supreme emperor of China. So he began with a purge of the military. He got rid of a retired vice chairman. He started a broad and deep corruption program, which really was used as a guise to target anyone and everyone that could be a potential threat for him going forward. In fact, his anti-corruption campaign has probably been one of his most significant policies, actually, and a lot of people have been caught up with that. Xi Jinping even has an ideology. It's called the Xi Jinping's Thought on Socialism with Chinese Characteristics for a New Era. Bit of a mouthful, but only Deng Xiaoping and Mao, they had their own particular philosophies. However, despite all this authoritarianism, there's been significant economic troubles under Xi Jinping. Now, Xi Jinping took over when, this is obviously just after the global economic crisis in 2008. So China faced significant problems and a fallout from this because China relied on exports to the West and there was an economic crisis in the West. So one of the key things Xi Jinping had to do was come up with a new economic model, you know, move away from export-driven growth. But what you find is China's economic model largely remains the same. If anything, Xi Jinping has got even more authoritarian in implementing the same policy. What you also find is Xi Jinping has a very ambitious program to make China self-sufficient in certain future technologies, AI, robotics. And this is leading China to bump up against America. And there is a tech war really going on now between China and America. And probably the biggest challenge Xi Jinping has is we're used to China being the largest populated country in the world. We're used to China's population growing at a huge rate. But in 2021, China's population grew at the slowest rate. And in the next couple of years, China's population will start to actually decline. So what this means is China's workforce, China's youth, China's working age group is going to start to shrink, whilst the pensioners in the Chinese population, they're going to start to increase. This demographic time bomb probably comes at the worst possible time for China. So Yes, Xi Jinping's decade in power, I would say it's a mixed report. That China's facing many strategic challenges, and these have not been resolved, and they're growing in scope and depth. And Xi Jinping really has been quite focused on really maintaining his position and maintaining control. So obviously, we'll have to wait and see how this pans out. But despite the achievements, there's a lot of problems on the horizon for Xi.
Another thing that's been going on for about a decade now is the Belt and Road Initiative. How far has China got with this global infrastructure project?
Yeah, so for at least 5 years since 2013, the BRI project, Belt and Road Initiative, was getting a lot of media coverage. It was a grand project that nobody could get enough of. But for the last few years, what you find is not really in the news anymore. That's probably because there's other political developments going on. But really, the fanfare of a decade ago has now hit reality. And this is the major challenge. Obviously, for China, so the Belt and Road Initiative was really conceived after the global economic crisis 2008. The Chinese leadership realized that they can't continue with the export-driven model. So by about 2010-11, they realized they got to change course. Part of the strategy was the Belt and Road Initiative, which was to expand China's economic model to outside the country. So when Xi Jinping came in, his job was to implement it. He wasn't necessarily the father of this particular policy. So a decade on, China has signed memorandums of understanding with 150 countries and 32 international organizations, amongst which 46 are in Africa, 37 in Asia, 27 in Europe, 11 in North America, 11 in the Pacific, and 8 in Latin America. China is now the largest overseas investor, and China, I think, is the largest exporter or the export partner of about 130-plus countries. However, BRI has received a lot of negative publicity. In 2018, the former Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, he suspended the work on certain Belt and Road Initiative projects. We know what happened in Sri Lanka, where a port effectively was seized, taken over by China, because Sri Lanka was unable to repay the debt. That government has now been overthrown. And even in Pakistan, Imran Khan voiced concerns of the different projects, and he basically started a review. So the BRI has been getting a lot of negative publicity. Some of this is unfounded. So that you see a lot of claims about the BRI is indebting many nations. And that's funny, but that's coming from Western nations who the third world owe most of their debt to. So I'm not sure how China's debt is problematic when most of the debt by these countries is actually owed to them. So what you find, you said there's lots of projects around the world in the different regions of the world. So we actually analyze all the different regions where projects are, how they're going, what their numbers are, and really where they've progressed up to this moment. I think our probably key finding was is that it has hit reality. And the reality is that a lot of these projects, they're not actually financially viable. So China is building train networks and ports. And you have to ask the question, why is it in these places there were no train networks and ports in the first place? And that's because they weren't really profitable, or they weren't even the demand. So a lot of these projects China's building, they're building in areas where China's going to have to give a leg up for a very, very long time. So the economic viability of these is highly questionable. But the claim that BRI will change the world and that China aims to transform its economic model, these have not succeeded for the moment. So this BRI project, it's not a miracle. It can't transform places that are not yet on the verge of taking off. So how China plans to deal with this, how China plans to use the BRI for its domestic economic model, these questions after a decade still remain unanswered.
Now, as part of the competition between US and China, we find that US has banned Chinese access to advanced semiconductors in this year, 2022. Now, what impact will this have on the country's economic and tech development?
So, you said this is going to have a massive, massive impact. This is as good as an uppercut in a boxing match, if we were to use an analogy. Now, semiconductors, they regulate the current, the electricity in electronic products. And we're now in a position where we have products which are very small, they require high regulation of current and flows through them for them to operate. So we're talking on the one side, your mobile phone, your tablet. To the other side, you're looking at quantum computing. You're looking at servers. You look at some of the most powerful computers in the world. So China has a plan, and that plan is to eventually be a leader in the next generation of technology. So AI, robotics, raw materials, these sort of areas. And China, interestingly, it does produce a lot of semiconductors. It manufactures them. However, what you find, China largely manufactures the lower end of semiconductors. The more advanced ones, the more miniature ones, they're actually manufactured by Taiwan. And the blueprints and the intellectual property to most of this belongs to America. And this is how America was able to put an export ban on China, because all the, even the Taiwanese companies that manufacture them, they manufacture them for Apple, for Tesla, and for Intel. So these American companies own the copyright. They own the patent to these. And that's how they were able to put these restrictions on. So what this means is China has a problem now in the advanced chip areas. And semiconductors are not something you can just learn by China. It's quite a lengthy process. Even the machines that make semiconductors, and you know, some of these semiconductors, they've got components which you can't see with the naked eye. They're like at nanoscale. So the machinery for this is very sophisticated, made by a handful of companies, all with an office in America. So the tech war has started. The war to be the future tech leader has begun. And if you take your mind back, all the global powers historically have had a lead in technology. When they lost that lead, they lost their position. If you look at Spain, Portugal, if you look at the Netherlands, if you look at the British Empire, if you look at Germany, all of them, they competed with the power of the day, and whoever won, they were able to define the global power. So that's why the semiconductor wars, the outcome of this will have a massive impact on who the future power is and who shapes the world.
Now, I'm sure we've got loads of questions with China and US, but we won't have enough time for the rest of the report. So we're going to move on to Europe. Now, they've been impacted massively with Ukraine's invasion by Russia. And in the report, you mentioned the energy crisis in the continent and also the strategic decisions that Germany now needed to make. Where does this all leave Europe now?
So Europe, Yusuf, is in a very precarious situation. And really, there are no good short-term options. They're all bad options in the short to medium term. And the reason why this is for a long time, Europe had no problem with Russian energy. Russia supplied a huge volume of energy through supply lines, through pipelines that go from the Urals in Russia all the way up to Germany. And no other country, no other single country could provide such a regular supply of energy. All of that is gone now. Literally overnight, that has gone. And I think 45% of European energy, European gas, comes from Russia. 94% of European oil come from Russia. And about 35 to 40% of European coal come from Russia. So if you've overnight stopped all this energy coming, you need to now replace that by someone else. And there is no good short-term option. No one country can provide all of that energy at that volume, at that price to Europe. That's why you're finding Europe's looking at North Africa, Europe's looking at the Caucasus, Europe's looking at Central Asia. But for the moment, it looks as though Europe is just relying on American LNG, liquefied natural gas. And this is where gas is turned into liquid because it's less voluminous. And then you need ports on Europe to regasify it again. This is very expensive, to the point where European countries are getting into debt. So in effect, Europe has made a decision which is going to have massive economic fallout. I mean, there's already been talk of winter of discontent in Europe. And the most affected by this has been Germany, because Germany imports 99% of its oil and gas. So you've seen massive price hikes of energy in Germany. Basic prices of derivatives of oil and gas, so plastics, of cooking oil, have gone completely through the roof. And Germany is going to have to make a strategic decision. Are you going to side with America politically? who gives you security, or are you going to side with Russia, who keeps the German people warm during the winter? For the moment, Germany decided to get in bed with America, but that's going to have significant implications for it going forward. So really, the most interesting insight we found is all the options for Europe on getting rid of Russian energy, all of the possible options are all bad options in the short to medium term.
Now, I know we've also felt the energy crisis in Britain. It doesn't seem as rosy as it was made out to be post-Brexit. We were told that post-Brexit, there would be a lot more wealth available. There would be a lot more money towards the NHS. What's gone wrong with Brexit?
So it's very simple, Yusuf. The whole Brexit narrative of a utopia, the promises that were made were all a lie. They were never going to be true. Just 2 weeks ago, Yusuf, there was a report by a think tank in the UK, and it said that food prices have gone up. One of the reasons is because of the red tape and the extra tariffs based on the imports of food coming from Europe. All the arguments for Brexit were based on things will be great, we'll get rid of the red tape of the European Union, we'll take back control. And they've taken back control, but nothing changed for the people. In fact, things have got even worse. And that's why, you know, people are calling Britain now Banana Republic. At the moment, the nurses on strike, the railway staff on strike, the police look like the gang on strike, teachers want to go on strike. Everyone's striking, and this was after Brexit was supposed to be great. And I think Britain's got some very important strategic decisions to make, because how are you going to engage globally when you are completely dysfunctional at home? And Brexit just hasn't been the utopia that they promised. If you think about it, Yusuf, it doesn't make sense. Half of your trade is with a continent across the water from you. You now leave a trade deal with that continent. So that now means you are like any other foreign country and you've got to pay taxes and tariffs. Surely prices will go up. How is leaving your most important trade partner a solution to your problems? So unfortunately now, you're now seeing the repercussions of that.
Now, obviously, this is something very close to us. We're living this lie that you mentioned. Isn't anyone accountable for this lie that was pushed?
So in the last four years, I think we've had six different prime ministers. In the last year, we've had three different prime ministers. Politically, the country is in such a mess, there's actually no one to account because the prime minister doesn't last for long. So the political drama being played out really has diluted and overtaken the repercussions of Brexit. So, I mean, just a few weeks ago, we were talking about Liz Truss, and, you know, within 40 days, she was gone. So what you find is, yeah, there are people that need to be accountable, but what you find is there's bigger problems going on in the country. The Tory party is so divided amongst each other that the drama that comes from there completely dilutes and drowns out the unfortunate drama of Brexit no longer being a utopia.
The global economy has been massively hit by the Ukraine war, and it was already really struggling from the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, we've got a section in the report about deglobalization. Is this really the end of globalization?
It's definitely the end of globalization as we've known it for the last two, three decades. America was talking about a globalized world after World War II, but the Eastern Bloc got in the way. Once communism collapsed, you saw globalization expand on steroids. So you find the former Soviet republics all became part of this global market. Borders and tariffs and restrictions to trade all went away. And what you found was many companies from the West, they moved their manufacturing facilities abroad. One of the reasons that led to the rise of Donald Trump in America was he got support from areas where many of those companies shut up shop and they moved their production facility to China. So all these people in the Rust Belt lost their jobs. So what you find is for the 1990s, all you saw was praise of globalization and how people would benefit. But really from the 2000 onwards, most people have seen the problem of globalization. What they see is jobs that should be in their country have gone abroad because it's cheaper. What they find is money that should be invested in their areas, it goes abroad. And what they also find is you see people, immigrants, moving from other places because we're supposed to be as one market. And really, these trends are what led to the rise of populism. It led to the rise of people like Trump, Boris Johnson, And if you look at it, all of these guys ran campaigns on being anti-globalization, on taking back control. I think probably the biggest example of this was the demand for PPP equipment, personal protective equipment during COVID. What most countries found was the manufacture of this was abroad, and countries like China and America, they were hoarding this equipment for their population. So where it used to be that you should meet production abroad, have a global supply chain, we're now seeing that countries have seen that supply chains need to come domestic. We need to be more and more self-sufficient rather than allowing companies to go abroad, because that makes you vulnerable now to global issues, global developments. So this trend is being called deglobalization, and most leaders have a mandate from the people to bring things back home. I mean, just last week, America passed the Inland Revenue Act, which basically is a piece of legislation that gives tax breaks to companies that work in the green sector and other sectors, on one condition though, that you manufacture and bring your production to America. So it's giving privileges to domestic companies over foreign companies. So Macron and China, they plan to take this to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, as a contradiction and a violation of their trade agreement. But that's going to be the trend now. What the public want to see is their companies come back home as supply chains being local rather than global. So I think it remains to be seen if it's the end of globalization, but it's definitely the end of what's been going on for the last 3 decades.
I guess Brexit is another example of that as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at most people who voted for Brexit, take back control, control their borders, all of these were economic nationalism over globalization and, you know, integrating more with the world. There's more, I mean, these are the sort of things that will lead to more differences. It's going to be nation versus nation, great power versus great power, competition versus other people. While for the last 3 decades, the mantra was, we're cosmopolitan people, we're a global society, let's get rid of all these barriers. Now the demand, the public opinion, is for barriers to be erected, and they see that as a better protection. Most people see that as a better protection of the economic well-being.
Now, in the report, Adnan, you discuss the BRICS organization, and you put it in a quite a funny way. You say they're all bricks and no mortar, but many people, they see it as the emerging bloc, which will counter the Western-led liberal order. What do you make of that?
So, Yusuf, over a decade ago, I was a fanboy of the BRICS organization. I felt finally we have another organization that could probably compete and counter the existing liberal order-led organizations like the World Bank, WTO, and, you know, BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. These were new mid-tier emerging nations, and they felt they have little say over the global order, because the global order was written by Europe and the West. And, you know, they were presenting themselves as a potential new order going forward. But a decade or so later, Yusuf, what you find is they're still doing lots of talking, but they're doing very little doing. And the reason why that is that, you know, the BRICS organization is not, it's not like the World Bank, the IMF, World Trade Organization. It's really an informal grouping of countries of a certain type, you know, future economic powers, who come together and talk. They've actually got no institutional power, because it's not that sort of organization. And the reason why that is because each of these countries, although they have similarities with each other, really they have more differences. You know, each of them are at different parts of their development, and each of them have a more important relationship with America and the West than they do with each other. So countries like China and Russia, they like to promote this organization as a possible alternative, and they like the credibility it brings to them. However, practically, it does nothing. It does very, very little. So even if you look at the loans this organization has given out, it's minuscule compared to the IMF and the World Bank. So I think this organization is great on paper. It brings credibility to China and Russia. But beyond that, physically, it does absolutely nothing. Now, does that mean it's always going to remain like that? Not necessarily. But really, it's not a full alliance between these countries. Really, on paper, there's an alliance. In practice, there really isn't. I mean, the fact that India and China refuse to openly side with Russia in this invasion of Ukraine because they want to still maintain their ties with America, and the West, shows you that the relationship between them is quite tenuous at best.
Now, you talk about central bank digital currencies, also known as CBDC. Can you tell us a little bit more about these? Should our readers know about them?
Yeah, they absolutely should know about them. These have been quite, I mean, all the talk's really been about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. Central bank digital currencies are similar in some ways, but different. If you look at things like Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, these are decentralized currencies where you use blockchain as a way to make transactions and regulate money. So obviously in cryptocurrency, the money doesn't physically exist. It's an algorithm on your phone, on your computer. What central bank digital currencies are is the central bank version, which you think will be a bit contradictory because the whole idea of a cryptocurrency is you take the banking industry out of the equation. The normal financial system we have is you have central bank at the center and everything goes through them. So cryptocurrencies was the opposite today. When you decentralize it, when not, the banking system doesn't dominate finance. What central bank digital currencies is central banks hitting back. And because of their financial power, they basically can completely digitalize a national currency. So this is being trialed in a handful of countries and the results not being great yet. However, if you look, if you have digital currencies, if you have a currency on your phone, there's no physical currency, you can transact in a different way. And it also means crime, organized crime, goes out the window because how are they going to use money? And more importantly, every transaction, however small, can be monitored because money is an algorithm. So this has huge implications for an economy, for the nature of the economy. It has a massive impact because the physical money you have changes. So for the moment, we have physical money. You have obviously financial, you have your bank account where you have money. If you get rid of that all and all you have is digital currency, it fundamentally changes how we transact, the volume of transactions we can have. And it also puts central banks in a very key position because they could cut you off from accessing your money. They could give you more money than you need, so you would do things with it, which will stimulate the economy. So this is quite a significant development. So in the report, we do cover the prospects where this currency, there's still a way to go, but it will see the birth has taken place of central bank digital currencies, and you know that's going to have massive implications.
The geopolitical issue that you have done a deep dive on is oil. Now, oil has been on the news a lot this year because of the war in Ukraine and many other issues. What were the main conclusions and key insights in the report?
So, yeah, we had a lot of discussion, the team here at Geopolitics, on this chapter. So what we've tried to do is really just look at the oil industry, the oil situation, and draw some conclusions from it. So in a way, we started very neutral at this. So, you know, simply put, Yusuf, the world, obviously before COVID, was consuming about 100 million barrels of oil a day. And what you find is America, Russia, Saudi, they're the largest producers. And the largest consumers are China, India and Japan, and then Europe. So there's significant challenges evolving regarding this. So obviously, where is future oil going to come from? What are the regions that's going to produce future oil? As the population is growing, there's going to be more demand for oil. Obviously, the biggest change that's happened is America. America, who over a decade ago was one of the largest consumers of oil, now is not just it's not even the largest consumer anymore. But it's actually the largest producer. So the shale revolution that took place has turned America into a major oil manufacturer, major oil producer, rather than being an oil consumer. And that has massive implications. You know, I remember George W. Bush saying that the oil in the Middle East effectively is a tax on the American people. You know, that should be really, because of America's dependency, he saw the security and these sort of issues around oil effectively being a cost to the American consumer. So the oil market, you know, that's been probably the biggest shift. So in the report, we do have a look at the major oil producers. What are the challenges they face? You've obviously got decarbonization. There's a big move to move away from fossil fuels due to a variety of issues, including climate change. But what we're finding is that oil is just in a very, very unique position. The amount of energy per kilowatt, the amount of energy per unit you get from oil is very unique. Now, global transport primarily runs on oil, and there's still a long way to go for transport to get off oil. And if you think about it, the last 100 years, the oil companies have been some of the key geopolitical companies in the world due to their demand. The demand for oil is only going to go up. as global population increases. So we're consuming about 100 million barrels of oil a day. Where are the next 10 to 20 million going to actually come from? Because most, although some regions can increase the amount of oil they're producing, there's only so much they can do. There isn't a problem on the supply side as such, because countries are producing large amounts of oil. The issue really is, can the world transition beyond oil? So yes, new resources are coming online, but what you find is the increase in energy the world needs, the percentage increase every year, for that, there is renewable energy and things like that. But what you find is, for the moment, there won't be any transition beyond oil, because oil really is in quite a unique position. Until another fuel is found that can get you the same amount of miles you get in your car, really oil is here to stay. So oil, you know, who manufactures it, who consumes it, how much reserves a country has, all of these have geopolitical implications. That's what makes oil very important. And oil still remains the most traded commodity in the world. So it really shows this important position. And, you know, who produces it, who consumes it, who controls it, these are still going to remain major issues for the foreseeable future.
Thank you for your time today, Adnan. Now, the report, Strategic Estimate 2023, it will be published on the 2nd of January, and you can download that from our website. Now, we've got a lot coming up in the next couple of weeks. We have our 2023 forecast that will be coming out soon. I will be sitting down with Adnan and we'll record our 2023 forecast podcast. We'll also be publishing a 2023 forecast in both article and video form, so keep an eye out for that. Thank you for your time.